You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to an author debriefing from the International Spy Museum. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Here at the Spy Museum, we get the world's most interesting authors, including journalists, scholars, former spies and intelligence officers, coming in to answer questions about their latest works dealing with espionage, intelligence, and other national security issues. Please join me in listening to another of our selected author debriefings. We are joined today by Tom Ryan, who began his career in intelligence after being drafted into the United States Army in 1957, serving 3 years in the U.S. Army Security Agency, which is in charge of signals intelligence for the Army. After completing his military service, Tom signed on with the Department of Defense as a civilian and served in a variety of intelligence-related capacities, including at the analytical, managerial, and executive levels over the next 35 years. In retirement, he pursued his interest in the Civil War and traveled extensively visiting many Civil War sites around the country. He became a special contributor to the Civil War page of the Washington Times and published over 60 articles and book reviews from 1997 to 2009. From 2003 to 2005, he published a five-part series of articles in Gettysburg Magazine dealing with intelligence operations. Tom is also a member of the book review staff of the Civil War News, and he's written reviews for the Washington Post and North and South Magazine. He also published a study about Irish immigration to America during the Civil War in the Irish Sword, the Journal of Military History, Society of Ireland. Since May of 2011, Tom has been writing a column for the weekly newspaper The Coastal Point, Ocean View, Delaware, titled Civil War Profiles. The column focuses primarily on the state of Delaware's participation in the Civil War. He self-published a collection of these articles titled Essays on Delaware During the Civil War, A Political, Military, and Social Perspective. Tom frequently speaks on Civil War subjects at libraries, historical societies, and civic organizations. He is former president of the Central Delaware Civil War Roundtable and a member of the Gettysburg Foundation, Civil War Trust, Fort Delaware Society, and Delaware Historical Society. He is also the author of Spies, Scouts, and Secrets in the Gettysburg Campaign, How the Critical Role of Intelligence Impacted the Outcome of Lee's Invasion of the North, June and July, 1863. Tom, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at the International Spy Museum.
My pleasure. Be here.
So whenever we have authors on, I want to ask about inspiration. There are a lot of books written about Gettysburg. If you went to a bookstore or a library, you'd just have shelves full of books about this very famous battle. What inspired you to write yet another book about the Battle of Gettysburg from an intelligence perspective?
Well, of course, with my background, 38 years in intelligence, when I started researching the Civil War, I discovered there really wasn't very much or had been written about intelligence. As a matter of fact, you can count on one hand the number of books that have been written about military intelligence during the Civil War. So that was my motivation. Because of my background, my interests, I wanted to... Actually, I wrote a review of a book that was published back in the early 2000s about Grant's Secret Service by William Fitus, a professor out in Iowa, at a university in Iowa. And at the end of that review, I said, what's needed is, in this field, are reviews of the individual battles, taking a look at both sides, how they collected and used intelligence. Little did I know, 12 or 13 years later, that I would be the one
right.
who actually started writing that, because not very many people actually are writing about intelligence during the Civil War.
Well, and even when they are, they're writing about big picture intelligence, about strategic intelligence, and there's very little about military tactical intelligence on the ground level, which is what your book deals with more than any other I've seen.
Exactly. Yeah.
So another question I constantly want to ask our authors is about sources. Now, for a lot of our authors writing about more modern intelligence operations, they run into trouble when it comes to classification and the ability to get certain documents or certain information. You don't have that issue, but when you're dealing with time periods that are 150, 200 years old, you have a whole other set of problems when it comes to sources. Can you talk a little bit about how you came across the documentary evidence for this book?
Well, it's interesting that the National Archives actually has a collection of documents that pertain to the Bureau of Military Information, which was the Army of the Potomac's intelligence staff. However, those documents were hidden away for the better part of 125 years, and no one knew they were there until a former colleague of mine, actually, at the National Security Agency, discovered these documents and published a book about the intelligence operations in the for the Northern Army, and so those were the basis for the for this book, and also documents at the Library of Congress, certainly the official records. Mm-hmm. And if you comb through that very carefully, there are a considerable number of reports and messages and whatnot that relate to intelligence, at least in some respect, and you have to pull those out and use them accordingly.
So the trouble is just weeding through the documents and finding places where intelligence is mentioned that other historians just brushed over, hadn't noticed. They were focused more on the fighting on the ground. The stuff was right in front of them. They just never pulled it out before.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
So your book does a great job in demonstrating the importance of intelligence during the entire Southern invasion of the North, right? It'd be one thing just to focus on the three-day Battle of Gettysburg, but you've also focused on everything leading up to the battle itself, and then the aftermath of the battle. Why did you think it was important to include the before and the after in this book?
Well, especially the before. Of course, the invasion began on June the 3rd, which was an entire month before the battle actually took place up at Gettysburg. But there was a lot of maneuvering that was going on that eventually affected what the outcome of the Battle of Gettysburg. One incident in particular was when Jeb Stuart, who was the commander of the Confederate cavalry, the Army of Northern Virginia Cavalry, Robert E. Lee's Confederate officer, decided to try to take a shortcut through the Union Army, which at that time was stationary, sitting in front of Washington, D.C., to protect the Capitol from invasion. But there were seven corps as part of the Army of the Potomac that were spread out anywhere from 5 to 10 miles apart, so that a scout by the name of John Mosby went behind the Union lines and discovered that there was an opportunity for Jeb Stuart to take a shortcut, because he needed to get, because of Robert E. Lee's orders, he was needed to go into Pennsylvania and protect the right flank of one of the corps that had already arrived in Pennsylvania, and that was Richard Ewell's corps. And so Stuart trying to take that route was blocked from passing through because of intelligence that had been passed from Maryland Heights out in the Harpers Ferry area, and from Frederick, Maryland, where a Union spy had been sent up into the Maryland area to observe what Lee's army was doing. The information came back to General Hooker, who was the commander of the Army of the Potomac. He started his army moving northward, which blocked Stuart's mm-hmm. route through the so-called shortcut. As a result, Stuart was separated from the main army for the better part of the next week or so. And without Stuart's assistance, Robert E. Lee was had much greater difficulty in maneuvering when he eventually got into the area of Gettysburg.
But Gettysburg is a battle that many would argue was won and lost because of intelligence. Accurate and timely intelligence for the most part on the side of the Union, not so much as we just alluded to on the side of the Confederacy. But I would like to use you in this case to break down the systems themselves, kind of talk about how these two armies had their intelligence systems set up, because most people probably don't understand how complex the system was potentially on the Union side. And even in many cases on the Confederate side, there's a lot of different elements involved in the overall intelligence picture. And so I want to ask you about a couple of these. Someone that maybe people have heard of is Alan Pinkerton. Pinkerton as the private detective who is given credit for what later become the Secret Service. People look at Pinkerton as being kind of the master spy of the Civil War. And you basically say it not so fast. Can you talk a little bit about Pinkerton and his impact, particularly about Gettysburg, but overall as an intelligence officer for the Union?
Well, actually, Pinkerton was hired by General McClellan to provide intelligence for his army at the time. He was not really a part of the federal establishment. He was responded directly to General McClellan. When McClellan was relieved from his responsibility as commander of the Army of Potomac, Pinkerton left with him. So by the time the Battle of Gettysburg, or the Gettysburg Campaign, was happening, Pinkerton was long mm-hmm. gone. And as a matter of fact, his method of collecting intelligence was primarily through the use of civilian spies. And it really didn't have the military intelligence structure that would later be established. So Pinkerton was really out of the picture by the time the campaign began.
And in many cases, thankfully so, because you write in the book that McClellan had dramatically overcounted the Confederate Army, perhaps even 2 to 3 times his actual size, and Pinkerton didn't stand up to this. Pinkerton just agreed with his boss and kind of reinforced these bad ideas about how strong the Confederate Army was.
That's right. Yeah. And as a result, as you mentioned, McClellan thought Robert E. Lee's army was, in some cases, 2 or 3 times as large as his own, and in reality, it was about half the size, or even less, in the actual numbers that he had.
So, as you mentioned, when McClellan left, Hooker takes over, and that's where you start actually getting a little bit of organization when it comes to intelligence operations. And one of these smaller agencies is the Provost Marshal General. Can you talk a little bit about what they did and how effective they were?
Well, the Provost Marshal's responsibility was to, initially, as far as intelligence is concerned, is to make sure that the area where the Union encampments were located were secure, to make sure that there weren't spies. Of course, when you were down in Virginia, practically every civilian was a potential spy. Mm-hmm. So that was a very difficult job to do, is to try to maintain security. But the Provost Marshal General also was involved in interrogating prisoners, deserters, refugees, and escaped slaves, for example. And they would gather that information together and provide it to the commander with regard to anything that would be of value from a tactical or strategic point of view.
And they work closely with an organization you've already mentioned, the BMI, the Bureau of Military Information. And this, according to what I've read in your book and what I've read other places, is really the first American all-source intelligence agency, kind of the beginning of everything. Would you disagree or agree with that statement?
No, I would definitely agree with that statement, yes. Yeah, the BMI was established by General Hooker in early part of 1863. So by the time the Gettysburg campaign took place, they had already had experience. As a matter of fact, they were quite effective in determining the actual size of Robert E. Lee's army during the Chancellorsville campaign and battle. As they came within a very small percentage of the number of men that Lee had available, so that General Hooker knew at the time that his army was twice the size of Robert E. Lee's army. That didn't help Hooker in this case because ended up losing the battle, but that was his method, his methods that he used in that campaign was what led to his defeat.
And you also write that they essentially transformed the analytical process, that for the first time you have informed opinions of a professional intelligence staff that is informing the commander on the battlefield.
That's right. And what they were doing was gathering information from a variety of sources. And they would distill this information to what they thought would be interesting and necessary for General Hooker to use for his planning purposes. So.
And it was commanded by a man named George Sharp. Can you tell us a little bit about Sharp? I think he's certainly... He's not as well known as he probably should be for the impact that he's had on the history of American intelligence.
Now, George Sharp was a New Yorker. He was from Kingston, New York. He was a lawyer before the war. And as it turns out, that type of background was very applicable to the intelligence business. Prior to being selected as the head of the BMI, the Bureau of Military Information, he was a regimental commander and then became a brigade commander. So he had a significant amount of experience in the field that he could apply to his intelligence operations. So, he operated with a relatively small staff. He had a civilian by the name of John Babcock, who was very effective in putting together an order of battle of the enemy. Using information that was gathered through a variety of methods, as already discussed, such as interrogating the escaped slaves, the
prisoners and refugees
and that sort of thing. Yeah.
And then there's the more traditional military intelligence mechanisms that the Union Army had, everything from cavalry to signals intelligence. Which is your field, signals intelligence.
Exactly.
And Hooker seemed to use these much more effectively than McClellan ever did. I mean, he consolidates the cavalry into a single unit so that it can be used in a better way for intelligence. And then the flag units, which is basically the signals guys, seem to have been used much better at Chancellorsville, spreading disinformation and other kinds of deception operations. Can you talk a little bit about the other way, signals intelligence, cavalry, things like geospatial intelligence and creating accurate terrain maps and maps of the area, and how important this was to the Union cause?
Yeah, well, the Signal Corps, their basic job was the communications, but also observation of the enemy. And they were quite effective in helping to maintain communications between headquarters, General Hooker's, and later General Meade's command, and the individual corps, the seven corps of the Army of the Potomac. And they used both flag signals and field telegraph. In some cases, to help maintain that communication, but the cavalry, of course, was the armies depended on the cavalry, especially when they were on the move, because of their mobility, they were able to go out and scour the countryside and determine where the enemy was, what they were doing, and reporting back, you know, to the commanders. So, but, you know, the military telegraph, that was important, using field telegraph and standard telegraph lines and that sort of thing. But
And these were all encrypted as well. I mean, the wigwag system,
well, they could.
For the flags, they
could
encrypt
use
them.
Codes, yeah. and ciphers, and they did on many occasions, because both sides used basically the same system. So they certainly could read
right.
the enemy's signals, unless they were using codes or ciphers. Yeah.
Now, I'd like to contrast that to Confederacy, because I think it's pretty stark in contrast to what Lee's system was. Lee had no BMI. And so Lee was his own intelligence analyst. You know, you write that he personally examined and evaluated information about the enemy. He didn't have this kind of professional staff behind him.
That's right. And he relied almost exclusively on Jeb Stuart. And Jeb Stuart was a very effective information gatherer. He had proved himself time and time again prior to the Gettysburg campaign, first with General Joseph Johnston when he was subordinate to him, and then later with Lee, certainly at the Chancellorsville campaign, because it was Stuart who notified Lee that the Union right flank was in the air or undefended. And that's when Lee sent General Stonewall Jackson on a loop around the right flank and attacked and led to the defeat of Hooker, General Hooker's army at that time.
And the death of Jackson, too, I believe, right?
Am I
the death of Stonewall Jackson, too. Am I remembering my history wrong?
Exactly,
yeah, okay.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Death of Stonewall Jackson by friendly fire, right. By the way. It was interesting. North Carolinians, because it was dark, they didn't know he was there.
Right. So Lee had a background in intelligence, though, a little bit, didn't he? I mean, practical experiences during the Mexican-American War. He also knew all the enemy commanders on the North. He had served with all of them. I mean, they all knew everybody else, but certainly Lee understood the kind of mentality of the commanders he was facing across the battlefield. Would you say he was especially good at using and understanding intelligence, perhaps more than other people would be?
Well, I think very much so. He, of course, did have the experience, as you mentioned, during the Mexican War, and his commanders relied quite heavily on Lee at that time. And then after the Mexican War, he was in Texas on the frontier for a number of years and protecting settlers from attacks from Indians and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So he had a lot of field experience by the time the Civil War came around. And so he brought that experience to the job, so to speak, and applied it quite well. But he was also chose to maintain a very small staff so that he did not have the support and assistance that, say, General Hooker and General Meade had, because they did have the Bureau of Military Intelligence and other intelligence operations that supported their efforts.
We talked about Stuart's cavalry. I think what's interesting that you talk about here is the counterintelligence function of the cavalry and what they can do to screen movements of the army. And it's not just necessarily going out and looking for what the enemy is up to, but it's deceiving the enemy about your own forces. And I think that's such an interesting part of what the cavalry was good at. Can you talk a little bit about that mission of the cavalry?
Well, of course, when Lee was his army was marching northward, they began down the Fredericksburg, Virginia area, moved up to Culpeper, Virginia, and then moved west into the Shenandoah Valley. And Lee wanted to get to reach Maryland and Pennsylvania without the Union Army knowing that he was actually moving in that direction or where exactly he was. And in order to do that, he had to have his cavalry protect against the Union Army coming through the gaps of the Blue Ridge Mountains and finding out exactly where Lee was located. So that was Stuart's primary job at that time, in the early and middle part of June, so that And he was very effective in doing that.
Well, you're right that they use things like kicking up dust columns to make it look like the army was somewhere else, or campfires where there were no actual soldiers. A lot of ways to try to deceive the enemy into looking in the wrong direction, when actually the army was somewhere entirely different.
That's right. And Stuart was very good at that. He had the experience, and he applied it quite well.
Now, you've already mentioned Mosby and Mosby's Rangers, and I think this is very interesting. This is really people think about guerrilla war as maybe something of the 20th century. This is a true guerrilla force, at least the way that you're describing it in the book, of attacking soft, what we call the soft squishy parts in ex-military parlance, you know, behind the lines, places, forcing, you know, small units, forcing very large units to pay them a lot of attention, instilling fear, right? Another word could be terror, you know, and they're basically a hit and run guerrilla force that's causing just real problems for the unit. Can you talk a little bit about that unit and how it was set up?
Well, John Mosby actually had a battalion of a couple hundred, about 200 or 300 men. But often he operated in very small groups and operating behind the lines. He operated in the area known as Mosby's Confederacy, which was essentially Loudoun County and Fauquier County, Virginia. He knew the area inside out. He knew all the people in the area. He could get protection from them. He could melt into the countryside very easily. He could hit and run. He just developed an expert capability in doing that. And as a result, the Union Army had to use a large number of troops to try to protect their supply lines. And that was basically what he was operating against, were the Union supply routes coming down through Virginia. And let's say he was very effective. He was also effective in gathering information, and he was the one who had provided General Stuart information about the Union Army being stationary in front of Washington.
Right.
That eventually led, because of the good intelligence work on the Union side, to Stuart being separated from Lee's main army.
Well, we've talked about the fact that under Hooker, a lot of these agencies were set up, but Hooker stops being the commander right before Gettysburg, and George Meade takes over. We talk a little bit about George Meade and his experience with intelligence, because he, like Lee, did have a background, to a degree, during the Mexican-American War with intelligence ideas about engineering and topography and other things like that. Can you give me a little bit of his background and how he comes into the role of commander of the Army and its relation to intelligence?
Well, General Meade was very effective at the brigade, division, and corps level as a commander. And when President Lincoln and General Halleck, who was the general-in-chief at that time, were looking for someone to replace General Hooker, who had lost the Battle of Chancellorsville, and then decided to resign, actually, 3 days before the Battle of Gettysburg because of disagreements with his commander and with his general-in-chief. Meade was the one that they decided would be best to fill that position. Although Lincoln did inquire whether a number of other generals were interested, at least interested, in taking over the Army of the Potomac, but most of them recommended Meade, you know, for the job. Now Meade operated a little differently than General Hooker. Hooker, who had established the BMI, Meade was a lot like Lee in some respects, in that he preferred to rely on his own judgment to a great extent, rather than relying more on the BMI, the intelligence staff, who was generating reports. And so in that respect, he He was different from Hooker, but a lot like Lee.
Well, and that became an issue at Gettysburg because he, for whatever reason, holds on to the incorrect belief that Lee's army is much, much longer than it actually was, even though the BMI and several other sources are telling him, no, it's smaller. Meade, for whatever reason, has this perception that, I guess it's about 100,000 soldiers when it's really only about 60 or 70,000.
That's right. And this was a typical fault of the Army of the Potomac commanders dating back to McClellan and then Burnside, Hooker. They all inflated the enemy. And it was really an anxiety issue with these generals. They knew they were up against one of the best, General Lee. And Lee had won one battle after another. He had never lost a battle, as a matter of fact, until the Gettysburg campaign. And Meade reacted pretty much the same way as his predecessors did in facing Lee. And you can understand that in your
right.
Facing someone with a reputation
right.
he had. And here, Meade steps in to take over command 3 days before he actually has to go up against General Lee. So it was understandable, but at the same time, Meade was a very cautious general. He preferred to fight on the defensive. He was not very aggressive. Certainly didn't move out on the offensives on his own very often.
And we'll revisit that idea when we talk about after the battle. But let's jump into the battle itself, because I think there's some interesting events that take place. We're not going to revisit Gettysburg because it would take forever, but I think there's some interesting things that overlap intelligence very particularly. One of them has to do with Buford's cavalry. And it comes across from everything I know about it, plus your book, that he really does what Stuart should have done. And for Meade, he provides a concise, detailed assessment of the enemy forces on the field. It's hard to, if you've seen the movie Gettysburg, if you've read the books, Buford comes across as just the guy that saves the Union, many because he's in the right place at the right time. He holds off just his ragtag bunch of cavalry members, holds off the Confederate advance. But in the intelligence perspective, he's exactly where he's supposed to be, and he's doing exactly what he's supposed to be doing by telling General Reynolds and up to General Meade what is the strength and consistency of the Confederate Army.
Yeah. Buford was actually doing his job. And fortunately for Meade, when he took over the Army of the Potomac, he decided to appoint General Pleasanton, who was the cavalry commander for the Union Army, to his staff rather than out in the field. Because up to that point, General Pleasanton had done an atrocious job, if I might say, of misinforming in many cases, speculating about what was going to be taking place, giving advice to his generals rather than just gathering information and reporting what he found out about what was going on with the enemy. Buford did that job extremely well. Now, he assessed what was going on. He sent his cavalry out to locate the enemy, gathered all that information together, and wrote very brief and succinct reports for General Reynolds, who was the commander of the left wing of the Union Army, and it was closest to Buford at Gettysburg, and to General Meade himself. So that was a feather, certainly, in Buford's cap. And you already mentioned the fact that he held off
right.
the Confederate Army initially at Gettysburg. So he, in both intelligence collection and tactical operations, he did a very effective job.
There's another interesting escapade during the Gettysburg battle that has to do with the interception of orders sent to Lee from Richmond that Lee was waiting for to try to find out whether or not there would be a ruse to have Beauregard's army push forward and kind of pull away some of the Union Army, and at the same time whether or not he would be getting reinforcements himself. They get intercepted. They're not enciphered for whatever reason. And it really gives Meade a significant advantage over Lee during the battle itself. I've talked a little bit about it. Perhaps I should let you do the talking about this, but can you talk a little bit about this particular event that takes place?
Yeah, what took place? Well, to set the stage a little bit, Meade was staying in communication with Richmond, with President Jefferson Davis, and it took approximately 3 to 4 days for the couriers to go back and forth between the army. I mean, it's almost 100 miles, let's say, if not more, that they would have to travel. And in this case, as you mentioned, Lee had been requesting President Davis to bring up troops from the Carolinas and Southern Virginia and to pose a threat to Washington, because he had done this successfully once before back during the Chancellorsville campaign and that Peninsula campaign, I should say. But so he sent several messages to Jefferson Davis, and Davis responded. And the carrier was coming up through the Shenandoah Valley, came in through Maryland and Pennsylvania, but there was a Union cavalry group of about 100 troops under at the time Captain Ulrich Dahlgren, his name was, who intercepted the couriers in Greek Castle, and lo and behold, in the pouch was this response from Jefferson Davis to Lee. And Dahlgren immediately sent that to General Meade in Gettysburg. That took place on July the 2nd. So in the morning of the 3rd, Meade had this information that essentially said that we cannot provide you any reinforcements. We also cannot bring up troops to pose a threat to Washington, because we're concerned about the defense of Richmond,
right,
being threatened down there. So that's how that all.
Right. So not only does Meade know that Lee's not getting reinforcements, Lee doesn't know that Lee's not getting reinforcements because it's in Meade's hands and he doesn't have that information.
That's right.
Well, that's
and never finds out.
Right.
By the way, during the campaign.
So I want to end the actual discussion of the battle with something that most people, if they've heard of Gettysburg, has heard of, is Pickett's charge. George Pickett on the last day. You give it a little setup. He was the only division that hadn't fought on the second day of the battle. He'd been slow to get up, or he'd been fighting, providing a rear guard for Longstreet's corps before that. And so he is kind of the center of this final charge into the center of the Union lines. For those, I don't want to spoil the ending. It doesn't work. It's considered one of the most significant military disasters of all time. But what I think is interesting is what Porter Alexander argues about Pickett's charge. Porter Alexander was James Longstreet's artillery commander. And he argued that the charge failed not because it was a bad idea necessarily, but because Lee didn't have a good understanding of the geospatial intelligence of the battlefield. He'd understand the terrain as well as he should. And to me, that makes... We're in the spy museum, geospatial intelligence matters. That makes it interesting to me. Can you talk a little bit about how Pickett's charge fails because of Lee's misunderstanding of the battlefield?
Well, of course, that was Alexander's opinion,
right,
in that case. And he felt that Lee would have been better off attacking from the north, coming out essentially from the town of Gettysburg itself, because you had to picture the Confederate army was spread around to the west and to the north, and to a certain extent to the east as well of the Union position on Cemetery Hill and Cemetery Ridge. But what I think is particularly interesting about Pickett's charge is that the intelligence that was gathered by interrogating the prisoners that had been captured on day one and day two, and the BMI, the intelligence staff, was able to determine that the only fresh troops that Lee had left after the first 2 days of the battle were this division under right. Pickett. Now, Pickett had been, as you mentioned, he would had been back in Chambersburg protecting the supply line, and he did not come up until the 2nd. So, and that was a relatively small division as well, because a couple of the brigades had been held back in Richmond to the defense of Richmond. So Meade knew that the only fresh troops that he was going to have to deal with on the 3rd of July were Pickett's reinforced by whatever other troops that had already fought.
Right.
That, you know, that day.
So this is counterfactual history, but I'm going to throw it at you anyway. If what Alexander is saying is at least relatively on the mark, and if Lee had a better understanding of the battlefield, what, is it more likely that he would have bought into James Longstreet's idea of avoiding that last day of battle and swinging between Meade's army and Washington and forcing the Union army to attack and set up in a defensive position? I mean, that's kind of the famous what if of Gettysburg, is what if Longstreet had convinced Lee not to fight that last day on July 4th and instead reposition the Confederate army into a much better situation?
Well, and of course, and that gets back to the separation of Stuart. Stuart did not arrive until the 2nd of July, and so Lee did not have his cavalry available. At least he didn't have Jeb Stuart available. Mm-hmm. And he relied heavily on Stuart personally. He did have some cavalry available that he could have used, but chose not to. But the fact that Stuart wasn't there was a main factor. Now, whether or not going around to the left flank of the Union Army and getting between Washington and where they're positioned up there in Pennsylvania, that's a debatable question. It's hard. Right. It's hard to determine what Lee would have done if he had his cavalry. But without them, he felt unable to maneuver.
Right.
And so he did listen to Longstreet, who on more than one occasion recommended that he go around mm-hmm. and circle to the left flank of the Union Army, or actually behind Big Round Top and Little Round Top. Things might have been different.
Right, right. Well, things might have been different also in counterfactual history if the aftermath of the battle had gone a little differently. I mean, people realize, I assume, that Gettysburg was lost by the Confederate Army, that Pickett's charge fails. But the battle didn't have to necessarily end there. There was an opportunity for the Union Army to maybe even end the war at Gettysburg that they don't take. And, you know, many people talk about the Great Escape, where Lee is able to pull the remnants of the Confederate Army back into the South and escape from the North. And I think there's a lot of great intelligence aspects to this. Certainly there's deception operations. You talk in your book about things like Quaker guns and fake false campfires to mask this movement. And then Stuart, this is when he finally does show up, and his screening is key here. Can you talk a little bit about the Great Escape and how Lee is able to get this battered, beaten army back out of harm's way into the South?
Well, actually, when Stuart did come, did arrive on the 2nd, he was available when Robert E. Lee decided to withdraw on the 4th of July. After Pickett's charge failed, he knew he had to go back. He retreat to Virginia. But he had Stuart, and Stuart protected the army. And in addition to that, Meade decided not to pursue immediately. He took 2 or 3 days to rest the army, to resupply, so that Lee was able to move down into Hagerstown and eventually over toward Williamsport, which would be the crossing point of the Potomac River, mm-hmm. back into what was West Virginia and then down into Virginia. But it was Meade's hesitancy, let's say, that gave Lee the opportunity to get away with relatively minor damage. Now, he did send the cavalry out to harass, quote-unquote, Lee's army, but he didn't give them specific directions, give the cavalry specific directions to try and impede Lee's army. And that was a major difference, harass and impede.
Yeah, you're much nicer than me than I would. I mean, to me, from reading your book, it showed that Meade had all the necessary intelligence to know Lee not only was leaving, but that Lee was severely weakened. I mean, I just kind of counted things that you see. He had the data from the BMI, casualty reports, prisoners that he had taken and interrogated, wounded soldiers abandoned in makeshift hospitals, Signal Corps observations, the cavalry telling him, reconnaissance with infantry, all saying that Lee is trying to get away. He's basically limping his way back to the south. And to me, you could have captured the entire Confederate army here, at least forced them into a knockdown decisive battle to end the war. Again, counterfactual history, we never know what... Maybe Lee wins this battle, who knows? But it seems like one of the most egregious missed opportunities. But the war goes on for another 2 years, and tens of thousands more die. Do you see this as, I mean, you're very nice to Meade, but it's a major missed opportunity.
Well, Meade really, after he won the Battle of Gettysburg, that was important to him, certainly. After that, he was more anxious to see Robert E. Lee leave and move back into Virginia. He would have been very happy if Lee was able to do that immediately. But unfortunately for Lee and Meade in this case, the Potomac River was swelled by the... It was raining for a couple of days during the retreat, so that Lee couldn't cross back over the... Over the river.
So not
so,
only wait.
So, so
not,
there was an opportunity for Meade to catch up.
Right. So
he
not
really
only
didn't seem to want to.
Not only did Meade know about this, but Lee was trapped in the north. Is that what you're saying? He couldn't get over the.
Oh, he was definitely trapped. There's no question about that. The when they came north, they had a pontoon bridge, but the Union Army, there was another division under General French down in Frederick, while the Battle of Gettysburg was going on. And French realized that after the battle, that he, by destroying that pontoon bridge, Lee would not be able to get away as easily. And that was the case. But Lee was able to rebuild the pontoon bridge. And Meade was aware that that was going on. And yet he did not send cavalry across the river to come up from Harper's Ferry and attack or destroy that bridge. It was another indication that Meade was very happy to see Lee leave.
Which is, I mean, what you hear about the Civil War, particular from about Lincoln, is that Lincoln micromanaged the war in many cases. It's amazing to me that Lincoln wasn't just screaming at Meade to go get Lee, or was he?
Well, he was indirectly. He operated through General Halleck, who was the general-in-chief. And he would tell Halleck what he wanted to see done. As a matter of fact, he wrote a message to Halleck that said, "We have news that Vicksburg has fallen. Now, after the victory at Gettysburg, if General Meade follows this up, it very well may be the end of the war. At this point, if he could either literally or somehow destroy Lee's army, But
it's easy to Monday morning quarterback this, but it just seems like missed opportunity after missed opportunity. And I guess what Meade stays in command until 65, right? Doesn't Grant take command at the very, very end of the war and kind of just finish things off? Am I wrong?
Well, you're right. Meade, for the next 9 months, actually, was still in charge of the Army of the Potomac. But in May of 1864, April-May, Lincoln appointed Grant the general-in-chief of the Army, to replace Halleck. But Grant chose to accompany the Army of the Potomac. He kept Meade in command of the Army, But in effect, he in fact was commanding.
Which I found, I thought I knew a lot about the Civil War, but you know, you talk about, the succession of commanders is McClellan, Burnside, Hooker, Meade, Grant, but Grant actually wasn't the same level as the rest of them. No. Grant was the same level as Halleck, kind of the George Marshall commander, you know, the chief of staff type in Washington, and Meade was still the commander of the Army of Potomac till the very end.
That's right. As a matter of fact, when Grant marched down and established the siege of Richmond and Petersburg, he actually had three armies there. In addition to the Army of Potomac, he had the Army of the James, and then he brought in the Army of the Shenandoah under my friend. I can't think of his name right now.
more detail.
Sheridan. That was Sheridan.
Sheridan, yep.
Yeah, that was Sheridan. Edward Ord was the commander of the Army of the James. So he actually had three separate armies. Mm. So Meade was still commander of the Army of the Potomac.
Which is the most famous, but it wasn't certainly the whole. I guess there were, 9 or 10 armies that were operating under the Union during the Civil War. You don't need to know the exact number. Yeah. This is stuff I used to know. I'm just remembering now. So the book is Spies, Scouts, and Secrets in the Gettysburg Campaign, How the Critical Role of Intelligence Impacted the Outcome of Lee's Invasion of the North, June-July 1863. It is fascinating. It is the most detailed account that you will get of the ground truth, the tactical intelligence, the battlefield intelligence of this Battle of Gettysburg. And the author is Tom Ryan. Tom, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at the International Spy
Museum. My pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this author debriefing. We'd like to know if you have any questions or comments about it. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. We look forward to you joining us again for another of our author debriefings. And thanks for listening.